From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 121, The Sad Tale of Marian Zajonczyk. In 1932, when Marian Zajonczyk was first elected to Congress, the majority of Americans had a higher level of regard and faith for their representatives than they do today. Despite this, it was obvious that Marian Zajonczyk struggled with mental illness during his time in Congress, and the shenanigans he got into were sure to provide tons of inspiration for the media. Marian was born in Poland on the 5th of December 1901, while that country was still a part of the huge Austrian-Hungarian Empire. When Marian was 4 years old, he moved to Seattle with his parents. Zajonczyk established a name for himself at the University of Washington, where he served as president of the student body. He was endowed with a bright mind and a charismatic personality that won over others. Zajonczyk was active in the Democratic Party in his community while pursuing his legal education and earning his law degree. Even though he garnered the support of many people affiliated with the Democratic Party, some of the local Democrats in the area believed the future congressman to be an extreme member of the party's left wing. The Great Depression was having a negative impact on the entire country, including the Evergreen State. Both the Republican Party and the state politics of Washington were about to undergo significant shifts. Marian Zajonczyk was only 8 years old when Wesley L. Jones was elected to a seat as the United States Senator representing Washington State in 1909. Jones had served in Congress continuously since 1899 and was regarded as an icon in Washington state politics. In 1932, Jones was running for re-election to the United States Senate for the fifth time. Senator Jones and the rest of the Republican candidates on the ballot were unsuccessful. It was a humiliating loss for such a longtime incumbent, and Jones won just under a third of the vote. The politics of Washington State's first congressional district had been dominated by the Republicans for years, and during that time, Congressmen John F. Miller and Ralph Hoar were engaged in a conflict with one another. In 1930, Congressman Miller had been defeated by Hoar in the primary election for the Republican Party, and Hoar went on to win the general. The defeated former congressman decided to run against his successor in the Republican primary election in 1932, where he emerged victorious. Marian Zajonczyk was able to defeat former Congressman John F. Miller in the election of 1932, thanks to the intense competition within his own party as well as the effects of the Great Depression. Zajonczyk had previously served as the leader of the Washington Commonwealth Federation, which was an organization that advocated production for use, not profit. The Unemployed Citizens League, UCL, was a self-help organization that was founded in 1931 by unemployed men and women in Seattle. They planned relief efforts and drew together those who had been dormant since the early 1920s, including reformers, liberals, trade unionists, and revolutionaries. The UCL was instrumental in John F. Doerr's successful bid for the mayor's office of Seattle in 1932. Nonetheless, the presence of communists within the organization undermined its credibility significantly in the eyes of the majority of the day. Upton Sinclair's Manifesto for a California Commonwealth proposed a novel and more democratic vision during his unsuccessful bid for the governorship of California in 1934. In that same year, the UCL established the Commonwealth Builders, Inc. in order to embrace a more diverse membership base. The purpose of the CBI's involvement in the Democratic Party was to promote social and economic change. The group came to the conclusion that the state and federal governments had the keys to both immediate relief and permanent improvement. In spite of the fact that Commonwealth Builders, Inc. strongly believed that state and federal governments should implement reforms, the company maintained a strong focus on Seattle. In June of 1935, members of the CBI convened in the Jade Room of the New Washington Hotel with several clubs of the Democratic Party. Technocrats, those who felt that government should be run by technicians who were led purely by the imperatives of their technology, farmers, and representatives of organized labor, and they reached an agreement to form the WCF. Conventions were conducted in Tacoma and Everett with the purpose of developing a statewide platform advocating production for use rather than production for profit. Vacant factories and farms would be put back into production, and workers would be able to exchange the scrip they earned for their pay at publicly owned chain stores. Goods would also be supplied through these stores. WCF functioned as a coalition that, for the most part, took on the agendas of its member organizations. Cyrus Woodward, a previous member of the UCL, served as the organization's first president, while Howard Costigan was the organization's executive secretary. In 1936, the WCF was able to exert its will and control over the state Democratic Convention. It was during this convention that Warren G. Magnuson, the prosecutor for King County, was elected as the party's permanent chairman. Initiative 119, which would have established the WCF's production for use program, was also proposed by the WCF. However, that initiative was soundly rejected by voters. Despite the success of the Democratic candidates backed by the WCF in their respective contests, including Magnuson for Congress, according to the historian Albert Asina, in practice, the WCF really meant the few dozen individuals who could be called upon to perform the tasks of speechmaking, organizing, and volunteering in the WCF office. The organizers were very skilled in putting on events like rallies, conferences, and conventions, as well as serving as an umbrella for a variety of affiliates. The WCF's primary objective was to exert influence over the Democratic Party. Because the WCF supported socialist concepts, including the nationalization of banks, public control of natural resources, old-age pensions, and pro-Soviet foreign policy stances, it was susceptible to charges that it was a communist front. It was well known throughout the Evergreen State that members of the Communist Party were active in the WCF. In 1939, President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was seeking support for a third term in office, became aware of the WCF. The anti-fascism and collective defense against German and Italian aggression that Roosevelt advocated received backing from the WCF throughout his administration. Meeting with Roosevelt and his advisors in Washington, D.C., Executive Secretary Howard Costigan, who was at that time an active communist, was instrumental in delivering Washington Democrats to Roosevelt's re-election campaign in 1940. During the Second World War, the WCF's influence began to decline and the number of its active members fell to a mere dozen. 1945 marked the dissolution of the organization having fulfilled its historical and anti-fascist role. Sorry for the meandering and a bit off-topic subject, but I didn't know when I would have the opportunity again to cover this, so I felt like this was the best episode to squeeze it into. Anyways, Zionchek was a fervent supporter of the New Deal and the programs of newly elected President Franklin D. Roosevelt when he was elected to the U.S. Congress. He was re-elected to Congress in 1934, but his behavior and the circumstances around him began to alter the following year. It was clear that Zionchek required some time off for leisure, and word quickly spread throughout the capital about the adventures he had been participating in. William Fishbait Miller, who served as doorkeeper of the house for a very long period, described some of Zionchek's outrageous antics, most of which occurred while he was drunk in public. The decibel level of the New Year's party hosted by Congressman Zionchek's home was so high that the party's neighbors called the police to report the disturbance. They discovered Zionchek in a drunken state having a great time at the apartment building's switchboard, where he was making calls and rousing the more subdued occupants in the building. Instead of placing the intoxicated congressman under arrest, the officers took Zionchek away to sleep it off. Even while the congressman was speaking on the floor of the House of Representatives, his behavior did not significantly improve. Zionchek did not keep his mouth shut and verbally attacked James A. Farley, who was the Postmaster General, chairman of the National Democratic Party, and the major dispenser of New Deal favoritism under FDR. He said, "There has never been a dumber or more inadequate man in office." Zionchek sneered at the individuals that sat on the United States Supreme Court, calling them either old fossils or corporate lawyers. During a heated discussion, a colleague of Zionchek's in the House of Representatives shot back that he was the jackass in Congress. While Zionchek was gone from the House floor, he did not alter his strange behavior. It seemed as though he was always getting into trouble for speeding, and at one time, when he failed to appear in court for a scheduled appearance, he was caught by police in the District of Columbia, who scoffed at his assertion that he was protected by congressional immunity. It wasn't too much longer after that that Congressman Zionchek tied the knot. The congressman, who was 34 years old at the time, allegedly met a woman named Ruby Nix, who was 21 years old and worked for the Works Progress Administration. He said that she had called him in the middle of the night. Zionchek stated that he left his apartment in order to look her over and came to the conclusion that she was okay. After waiting another week, they tied the knot. Zionchek wanted to make the most of the time he had left before leaving for his honeymoon, so he invited several reporters over to assist him in celebrating his recent marriage. While he was attending to his guests' gastronomic needs, he was resplendent in a traditional native headdress. The honeymoon of the newlywed couple was abruptly cut short on more than one occasion due to the fact that Mrs. Zionchek apparently shared a propensity for speeding with her new husband. In Virginia, she was given a ticket for speeding, while Congressman Zionchek had yet another warrant for his arrest issued because he had missed another court appearance. Both of them were involved in traffic accidents as well. After a high-speed chase, the congressman was apprehended in North Carolina, and the local sheriff was all too pleased to repatriate Zionchek to Alexandria, Virginia. However, the authorities in Alexandria were just as happy to let the issue go, and Zionchek was able to continue on his journey without any more incidents. The Zioncheks eventually arrived in Puerto Rico, and shortly thereafter, the congressman was involved in not one but two car accidents. He was also responsible for an incident that led to a disturbance, which Zionchek indignantly felt demanded the presence of United States Marines to calm down. There were also rumors circulating about that Zionchek's actions provoked at least one citizen to get so enraged that he challenged the congressman to a duel. Zionchek was photographed during a dinner party in the Virgin Islands lapping soup from his dish like a dog. This behavior was noted after he was convinced to leave Puerto Rico and travel to the Virgin Islands. Marion Zionchek was engaged in yet another automobile accident, and it turned out that the accident happened after he had bitten the driver on the neck. It seems that lapping soup was not the extent of his dog-like behavior. Zionchek stunned his traveling companions by drinking a concoction that he had come up with himself, which included rum and hair tonic as the primary ingredients. The congressman and his new wife continued their trip around the world for their honeymoon before boarding a ship that brought them back to the United States and docking in New York City. When he returned to New York after his honeymoon, he was met by a large number of reporters. This shouldn't come as much of a surprise considering the antics he had engaged in while on his honeymoon. Zionchek was in a Harlem nightclub when he hurled a glass at another patron, and the reporters did not have to wait long for other instances to occur after that. Zionchek continued to host reporters the following morning, despite the fact that he had not gone to bed until far after the sun had risen the night before. The cocktails he served were made with rye whiskey, honey, and a hint of mint. In the later part of the day, Zionchek delightedly kicked off his shoes and splashed around in the fountain at Rockefeller Center. He was enjoying himself in a public fountain for the second time, since he and Ruby had previously done the same thing in the capital city of Washington, D.C., and they had both received tickets there. When Congressman Zionchek got back to Washington, D.C., he ran into his old landlady, Pamela Young, who worked as a reporter. The elderly woman had finally arrived at the apartment that she had rented out to Marion Zionchek, and she was utterly appalled by the state that her home and its belongings were in when she saw them. The congressman was polite enough, but the distressed woman prompted Zionchek to lose his patience, and he was supposedly photographed yanking Mrs. Young out of her own apartment and into the street. Miss Young was sent to the emergency room where it was determined that she had suffered a hip injury. It appeared as though Congressman Zionchek was completely nonchalant with the situation as he continued to serve drinks to stunned reporters while offering his opinion that Miss Young was most definitely a communist. Mrs. Zionchek had evidently had enough at that point and vanished at some point during the night. This caused the drunk congressman to become depressed, and his mental state caused him to throw glass bottles and at least one typewriter out of the window of his apartment. The police returned once again, and this time they brought billy clubs with them, which they used to subdue Zionchek and force him to comply with their demands. After being released on bond, he exhibited conduct that was, if anything, even more unpredictable than before. He went to the Washington Zoo so that he could comment on the baboons there, and he singled out one of them for admiration because of the creature's somersaults. Zionchek came to the White House at a time when a fence had not yet been constructed around the presidential structure. He stated that the bag of varied ping-pong balls and empty beer bottles that he had with him was a present for President Roosevelt. Later on that same day, Zionchek was taken into custody once again. However, this time he was transported to a hospital rather than to a detention center. Marion Zionchek would be put on trial in order to ascertain whether or not he suffered from insanity. In reality, Zionchek had broken out of the asylum and was frolicking around the grounds when the arrival of his wife Ruby was announced. She attempted to have him transferred to a private hospital, but he once again evaded capture by fleeing the facility, sprinting through the grounds, and then disappearing into the neighboring woods. He then made his way back to Washington, D.C. by hitching a ride with the driver who was unaware of his presence. Zionchek made the decision to go back to Seattle rather than face the possibility of being charged and arrested again. On the entire journey back to Seattle, the congressman was accompanied by a police officer as well as the House Sergeant at Arms. This was done to ensure that the congressman did not take any unplanned detours. Congressman Zionchek had the mental capacity to recognize that his political standing within his district was declining, and he took appropriate action. A large number of potential challengers had submitted their applications to run in the 1936 election. After delivering a talk entitled "Who's Crazy?" in front of a sizable audience, Zionchek disclosed to the press that he would not run for re-election after being questioned about it by reporters from a variety of news organizations. He gave the diagnosis of manic depression given to him by his physician as the basis for his decision not to run. After these statements were made, King County Prosecutor Warren G. Magnuson made the announcement that he would be running for the vacant congressional seat that was formerly held by Zionchek. Zionchek and Magnuson were longtime friends and allies, and when Zionchek received the news that his old friend would try and seize his seat, many people believed he felt a deep sense of sadness and betrayal at his old friend's attempt. This is despite the fact that Zionchek had previously announced that he would not compete for a third term in Congress. Many people are of the opinion that this was the last act that Zionchek committed before arriving at the tragic afternoon in August. That month, Zionchek's mental state would force him to jump from the window of his hotel room on the fifth floor of the renowned Arctic Club Hotel in Seattle. He would plummet in front of his wife Ruby, who was waiting for him outside at the time of the incident. A brief note would be discovered in Zionchek's possession. It stated as follows: "My only hope in life was to improve the conditions of an unfair economic system that held no promises to those that all the wealth of even a decent chance to survive, let alone live." The Evergreen State, as a whole, was in a state of mourning after the death of their Democratic senator. Students and workers at the University of Washington and the world-famous Boeing plant were given a half-day off to participate in a moment of collective mourning following Zionchek's passing. Evergreen Washelli Cemetery is the largest of Seattle's cemeteries, and it is where Zionchek is laid to rest. Both the location of his tomb and the spot where he died can both still be visited today. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review, and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Knoxville Focus, the Columbia Magazine, the Seattle Times, the Spokane Daily Chronicle, HistoryLink.org, and Warren G. Magnuson and the Shaping of 20th Century America by Shelby Skates. Thank you for listening to episode 121, The Sad Tale of Marian Zionchek. Episode 122 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the whole. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.